Hello and welcome to Stepping into Truth. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very glad you're here with me today. This is the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I love these conversations that I have with people doing work in these realms, but these conversations aren't just meant to be intellectually interesting. They are meant to move us into action, action in our personal area of passion and interest. In this critical moment in time, each of us is being called to act. But what action looks like depends on who we are, what we care about, and what we have to offer. There's no one way of being an activist. Each of us needs to find our way. If you're wondering what type of activist you might be, I've got you covered. I created the Activist Archetype Quiz, which will help you find your way of sustainable activism. You can find a link to the quiz in the show notes and on my website, omkariwilliams.com. My guest today, Amanda Littman, has clearly found her way to make a difference. Amanda is the co-founder and executive director of Run for Something, a political action committee that recruits and supports young, diverse progressives running for down-ballot office. Since 2017, they've elected more than 300 people across the country. She's also the author of Run for Something, a real talk guide to fixing the system yourself, published by Simon & Schuster in 2017. And I'm really happy to welcome Amanda to the podcast. Hi, Amanda. I'm so glad you're joining me today.
I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you. So I really wanted to speak with you because I was kind of fascinated by the concept of Run for Something. And you launched it on January 20th, 2017, Inauguration Day. And then the next day was the first Women's March. And the world got to see the response to the election of Donald Trump in the millions of people who marched, not only here in the United States, but around the world. So you all launched on Inauguration Day. And what happened after that?
Well, you know, we expected it to be really small. We thought this was going to be our side project. We'd get maybe 100 people in the first year who wanted to run for office. Instead, in the first week, about 1,000 people signed up. And as of today, we're up to about 48,000 young people who've raised their hands to say they want to run, which is beyond our wildest dreams.
Wow. I mean, 48,000, that's kind of astonishing. How do you even handle that volume?
Well, we've built a program specifically around scale. So everything we do is thinking about how can we provide as many resources as possible to as many people as possible. You sign up on our website, you join a conference call in which we explain the basics of running for office. You then get screened by one of our volunteers. And our volunteers are trained to look for a couple key things. First, is this person progressive, whatever that means for wherever they live? Is this person running for local office for the first time? We want people who are running for things like school board, city council, state legislature, that kind of thing. Is this person willing to work hard? Do they understand what it means to run for office? And are they ready to do it? And is this person interesting and compelling? You'll notice nowhere in our criteria is this person have a lot of money? Is this person going to poll well? Do we think this person can win? We don't care. I mean, we care, but we don't really care. We're really looking for folks who are willing to invest in for the long haul. From there, people get access to a whole bunch of what we go to call our sort of passive resources. So things like online webinars, trainings, the materials that our partners put out, connections to other candidates. We have a network of about 500 mentors across the country who help candidates one-on-one. So maybe you need help designing a website or help talking about policy, or you want advice on your stump speech. We have people who will help you on their weekends or their spare time for free. And then we do endorsements, and that's how we winnow it down even further. So our endorsement application is public. Everyone can see it. Everyone can see our criteria and how we assess folks. We want to see your campaign plan, your budget, your win number. Again, we don't really care how much money you've raised. We don't really care what polling says. But we want to know that you have a plan as a candidate to actually talk to and connect with voters. And especially if you're running in a primary, do you have a progressive vision for the your community and a positive vision forward for your community?
That's
from there, we
amazing.
Endorse people. And endorsements we want to make include time with our staff. So our regional staff will travel the country, meet with our endorsed candidates, really engage with them, and depending on what they need, find it for them, whether that's chasing down somebody answering an email or just being a friendly ear who can hear your concerns. We'll also connect you to alumni we've worked with who may be going through similar experiences or have gone through similar experiences. And those are the folks that we track and that we engage with past their election. So we have, at this point, more than 900 alumni, 305 of whom have won elected office.
33% approximately. That's
just about, yeah.
A really, really good number.
You know, for first-time candidates, our expectation was that maybe 10% would win. Historically, it's really hard to win local office if you're a first-time candidate. It's entirely structured against you. So we are exceedingly happy with 33%. And even more than that, we know that about two-thirds of the folks we work with who lose are interested in running again. So this is a thing that will last for the long haul.
That's really fantastic. And it answers one of my questions, which is, why do you focus on younger people? But again, you know, when you recognize that the majority of people who are running for the first time are not going to win their races, to have that structure then in place for them to run again with all the knowledge and the experience and the infrastructure that they built in their first race is really powerful and sets them up so well for the next race.
Well, and our theory here is a couple of things. One, exactly what you're saying, is that we give people time to build experience and to build the skills, and especially for women, especially for people of color, for whom the criteria needed to be seen as, you know, viable is much higher, we allow people more time to build that experience. I also think it's important to note that young people are dramatically underrepresented in government. Only about 5 to 8% of state legislators are under the age of 35 out of more than 6,000 people who serve in state legislators across the country. Even in Congress, maybe 25 millennials, there should be about 100 of us.
Right.
And I think it matters not just for representation, but for the direct impact that has on policy. Imagine the change in conversation around affordable housing if there are more renters who are in the room. The change about parental leave when there are more nursing parents, nursing moms, or dads or parents with newborns in the room. Even conversations about like equal pay or birth control. It is a very different conversation when that issue is more personal for the legislators.
Absolutely. I mean, part of the reason that our laws look the way they look is because there's been such little representation from so many groups that people just didn't even think about it. I mean, you know, the structure was set up to serve a particular group, mostly white men,
uh-huh.
mostly older white men. And so they had very different concerns than a 24-year-old parent would have. So that's really important to factor in, and thank you for bringing that up. Something I wanted to ask you about, because I saw this online the other day. So let me just say, we're having this conversation a couple of days after what was, to be honest, a free-for-all Democratic debate. I mean, it was craziness. And you posted something online regarding the importance of down-ballot races in the context of how completely just off the wall this particular primary season is becoming in some ways. And I'd like you to talk about the whole concept of down ballot races and explain that for people who don't know what it means, and then why you feel that this is so important right now.
Well, down ballot races are everything that isn't the top of the ticket. So in a very practical sense, you know, you go to vote, you see your ballot, the top of the ticket will be the thing that covers the most possible people. So in 2020, it'll likely be the presidential election. Then it might be the Senate, then it might be the governor, then it might be the congressional race. And as you get lower and lower, the races will get smaller and smaller in terms of the number of people that they are reaching. Then you might have ballot issues or referendums, which is usually a separate component of your ballot. But for now, we're just talking about the elected positions. These are the races where your vote counts the most because the number of voters is the smallest. So you're thinking like 1 out of 100 or 1,000 or 5,000, as opposed to 1 out of 1,000,000 or 5 or 10 or 20 or 100 million. But more importantly, those are the races where the outcome will most directly affect your lives. A thing I think people don't always realize is the place where you're interacting with government the most directly is not with Congress, and it's not with the Senate, it's not even really with your governor or your state capital necessarily. It's with your library, it's with your streets, which are often run by your state legislature or your city council. It's with your restaurants and the liquor licenses and food and safety. It's with your schools run by school boards. It is really personal and it is incredibly meaningful, and it's all governed by the people who we elect in these local elections. So when people talk about, oh, the presidency is the only thing that matters, or we have to take back the Senate, we got to hold the House, yes, that's true. But if we don't also win these local offices, the practical impacts of these policies aren't actually going to be felt by people.
That's interesting, because it makes me think that in some ways, when we go to vote, that the ballots are upside down, that we should actually start with the local elections, and because those do have the most impact, and then work our way up to the elections that are national elections, and that people would have a very different understanding, because I think a lot of people go in to vote and they vote for president if it's a presidential election year, they vote for Senate, they vote for Congress, and then they leave because they're not informed, or they feel like, how does this really impact me? And what you just said makes it so much clearer, and I really appreciate that.
I really do believe it. I think the things that actually make a difference in our lives are governed for the most part by state and local office. And that's actually by design. You know, the Constitution enumerates there are certain powers that Congress can do and has, and the executive has, but everything else is delegated to the states. And even within states, much of the power is delegated to the counties or to the cities. There are certainly some mechanics around how this works in different states where, like, in New York City, for example, a lot of New York City laws are actually governed by the state capitol. That is sort of an exception to the rule. You have so much power over how your community runs if you take a stand in these local elections.
That's a very important thing for us to pay attention to, because I don't think that we really think about it that way. I think that most of us feel like our power is pretty limited. And yeah, we need to start addressing that concept, because that actually supports the status quo remaining exactly as it is. Mm-hmm. In your book, you said something that struck me really strongly, again, especially in the context of the primary season that we're in the middle of. You said that while being inspired by a candidate is great, it isn't required. And I'd like you to talk about that in the context of our current primaries and what happened in 2016.
Yeah, I think it's a really hard thing to wrap your mind around once you start getting into specifics. Primaries are a little different than general elections. It's certainly true. You know, in a primary, the stakes are who we are as a party. What do we believe? What do we stand for? So to a certain extent, in a primary, you should go with who gets you excited and for whatever reason they get you excited for. They can be for a personal attachment or because of the way they speak or because of their story or because of the policies they're fighting for and the vision they're presenting. In a general election, however, it is not a requirement that a candidate inspire you because the alternative is so clear. And I think this is enough. I am not necessarily one to say, like, vote blue no matter who. It's obviously every candidate should work for your vote. And your vote is not just about you. It is about so many people who are counting on you. It is about so many people who are feeling harmed. It is about more than just feeling good. It's about mitigating damage. If you believe that it is the lesser of two evils, and that's certainly a thing that one could believe if you want, that still means one is more evil than the other. That still means you have to stack rank them. You don't get to go off menu when it comes to our two-party system. For better or for worse, that's how we're structured. So for now, when you go vote, especially in a general election, I don't care if you don't like the candidate. You have to vote anyway, especially if you have the privilege of doing so. Because for so many people, voting is so hard. You don't have to be inspired by the candidate. I hope the candidates do inspire you. Either way, you do have a responsibility to show up, if only because there is someone on that ballot who will make a difference for your life.
I really appreciate that you said that the whole thing about voting isn't just for us, that it is also for other people, and that we have a responsibility to each other to do the best thing we can do in a circumstance. It may not be our ideal circumstance, but it's the best that we can do. Because, I mean, truthfully, if a lot of people who sat out the 2016 election had gone to the polls and just said, well, I don't like either of them, but I like him. I like her more than I like him, or I dislike her less than I dislike him, we'd be in a very different position right now. And I think we forget that. I think we look at voting as a very personal thing, and that's understandable, but I think that we forget the impact that our choices, our decisions have on people with a lot less privilege, a lot smaller voice than we may have ourselves. So I really appreciate that you said that, and it's, I'm going to sort of start saying that to people all the time now. Another thing that came up in your book that I really appreciated was a story that Senator Cory Booker, who dropped out of the presidential race a couple of months ago, I guess at this point, contributed with the title Do Something. And I really love that title. I mean, I feel like Do Something is the underlying theme of your book, Do Something. And I think people don't know what to do sometimes because they have a picture in their head about what an activist or a candidate looks like. But an activist or a candidate doesn't look one particular way. They look like each of us. And I mean, I've created a tool to help people clarify their style of activism. And when I read your chapter directed at those people who are not ready to run yet, or maybe ever, I thought again about how important it is that we know who we are as an activist. And I'd love for you to talk about how people who aren't ready to run and who may never choose to be a candidate for office can help, and how, depending on their personality and skill set, they can really make an impact in our system.
Yeah, I think it's really important to note that when you're faced with the idea of, I want to get involved, I want to do something, that's 80% of the fight. The idea of simply stepping up and doing something rather than nothing gets you so much further than most people who just complain. So thank you. If you are listening to this and you're like, I just want to do something, I don't know what, having that thought, 80% of the fight. Now that you've decided you want to do something, you have to really assess where is the place that you can make the biggest impact. Now, candidly, if you're looking to help on a campaign, which I think is often the place where we can move the needle the furthest, because the people who make the decisions are the ones we elect, and that allows more space for advocacy to be more effective, the most valuable thing you can do is knock doors. Knock doors. Phone calls are sort of second best, but really knocking doors. Now, I say this as someone who's like a pretty deep introvert. Knocking doors can be terrible. It's also really fun, but it can be terrible. It can be cold. It can be hot. It can be exhausting. You'll get doors slammed on you. You have to talk to strangers. It also is the most scientifically proven way to get people to show up to vote. So if you want to do volunteer work that really you know will make a difference, knock doors. That being said, there are tons of other ways you can get involved. Maybe you can make phone calls or send text messages. Maybe you can show up and clean the campaign office. Maybe you can bring baked goods or provide pizza or ensure that the volunteers have the water they need. Maybe you have leftover school supplies in your garage or your home that you can donate. Maybe you have a fridge or a table that you're no longer using that a campaign office needs. Whatever it is that you can provide, doing something is better than doing nothing. If you decide that campaigns aren't for you, is that you want to stay out of electoral politics, pick the problem you care about solving and find the advocacy group that is solving it. Even if all you do is show up to these meetings and listen, being in the room and your presence matters. You never know what could happen. You never know who else could be in the room. You never know what might be on the agenda. So going to city hall or town hall or school board meetings and just listening in, getting to know the people in the back with the clipboards who are the organizers, those are my favorite folks, and doing whatever needs doing. You know, it's a really annoying answer to a lot of people who are like, I'm a policy expert, or I'm a marketing executive, or I'm a award-winning graphic designer. All those things are great. Candidates will certainly need help with those skills. And what they might need you to do is clean the bathroom at the field office. And if you really care and that's what they need the most help with, no task is too small. No project is too unimportant. Do what you can. And it all helps ladder into the larger goal of allowing the candidate to spend his or her or their time the most efficiently and effectively. If a candidate has to spend an hour cleaning the field office, that's an hour they're spending not talking to voters. And we know that the candidate, him or herself or themselves, talking to voters is the most meaningful way to get people to show up and vote. So that being said, whatever you can do to help make sure the campaign is more efficient, the better.
That's such a great answer, because I think often we do feel like people should be interested in using our specific skill set, but sometimes they don't need our skill set right now. And to just go and have the humility, because, you know, our egos can get in the way, to go in and say, I'm here and I'm happy to do whatever it is that you need me to do to make a difference, is really powerful. And it's absolutely what campaigns drool over. It's like, oh yes, a volunteer who will do anything we ask. That's so great. And the same is true with any advocacy organization. Someone who's just willing to step in and do what is needed at that moment. And again, you never know. You never understand at the time what your impact is going to be. So I think that people need to just sort of leave their egos at the door and say, this is a cause I care about enough that I'm just going to do whatever it takes. So,
and the thing I would add on to this is to make sure that you're reliable. The only thing a campaign loves more than a volunteer who will do whatever project is needed is a volunteer who shows up reliably to do whatever project is needed. So if you say you can come every Tuesday from 5 to 7, and then you show up every Tuesday from 5 to 7 and do whatever is needed, even if you don't want more responsibility, you will get it because you are someone they can count on. And again, your presence matters so much more than you think. Simply being in the room makes a difference.
It really does. People, just in terms of sheer numbers and what it looks like visually, when you see a room, if there's someone just sitting there and by themselves, that gives you one idea about the organization or the candidate. And if you see a room with a lot of people, that gives you a very different vibe. And that actually matters. People are attracted to things that seem like they have some legs behind them. So yeah, that's really important.
Yeah, don't jump on the bandwagon. Be the bandwagon people are jumping onto.
Oh, I like that. That's a very good picture to keep in your head.
Yeah.
So I want to sort of switch gears a little bit and get back to people who are running for things or thinking of running for things. And I want to ask you, what are some of the common misconceptions that you and your team encounter when you're talking with prospective candidates? Some of the things that might keep someone from deciding to run for office?
People think they need to have a lot of money, which on the one hand, yes, you do need to have your financials in order. You should know where your income is coming from. You should be able to, you know, have some financial stability there. That being said, you do not need to be a millionaire or a billionaire or have a high net worth, any of that. All you need is to be able to be willing to ask for help. Fundraising is not fun. I will never say it's fun. However, it is much both easier and harder than you'd expect because money will come from surprising places. We will ask you to ask everyone you know, your friends, your family, your partners, your ex-partners, your dentists, your ex-dentists, to contribute. And that'll be scary, but you're not asking them for money for lunch. You're asking them to invest in their community and in your community. So it will be hard, but you will find surprising yeses, and that will be really gratifying. The second thing I think people think you need in order to run for office, which is not true, which is you do not need to be a policy expert. You do not need to have a long resume. You do not need to be a lawyer. You do not need to be a quote-unquote professional politician. All you need to be is a good listener, is someone who cares, and you need to be willing to learn. Most of the knowledge that people learn about policy is by living it, is by engaging with activists and think tanks and experts who you will learn from as you do the job. But that's also why having gone to these meetings or having been an advocate before you run or having been involved in your community before you run is really a lot of the foundational knowledge you'll need. So that helps too.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I do think a lot of people feel like, oh, I'm not qualified because I'm just a teacher, or I'm just a nurse, or my career doesn't have anything to do with whatever they think the whole thing looks like. But that's not true. And we all have the things we're passionate about, and we can learn about other things and bring everything we've got to the table. And that really helps. And you want a human, you know, want a human there. That really matters. And we've got that part down. So the rest of it is learnable. Yeah, thank you. I like that a lot because I do think that there are people out there who feel very strongly about things in their community and just feel like, well, you know, I'm not the person to do that because I don't have the credentials.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one of the things that I really appreciated about your book is that you, as you've said, you tell people up front, this is not going to be easy. This is really a challenging thing to do. And for you, I want to know how you've stayed motivated over the years and the inevitable disappointments that you've experienced in this realm.
It's a good question. You know, I think one of the biggest points of frustration for people more generally is a disconnect between expectations and reality. That's where frustration and anxiety and disappointment comes from, which is why we try to be really upfront with people about how hard it is to run for office. Because if you go in eyes open, your brain can handle that. Your brain can handle the having lowered expectations, candidly. I think for me personally, getting to work with local candidates is what makes it worth it. I never really took a break after 2016. I went straight from working for Hillary to run for something. And, you know, in some ways that was really hard, but it also was the most productive thing I could have done with my grief and my depression. Because getting to see people who are really making a difference in their lives, who are changing their careers and changing their life paths in order to make a meaningful difference is inspiring. And it's really gratifying to be a part of that. And that's a really good place to put my personal anger and frustration and sadness.
Yeah, that's so true, because it was such a heartbreaking experience, that loss. And as bad as I thought it was going to be, it's been so much worse. And I think that that's a feeling that a lot of people have. And to have a place to put that frustration and energy is so much better than just lying in bed with the covers pulled up over our heads or, you know, endlessly binging CNN or MSNBC and screaming at the television. So we can take that energy and actually apply it by supporting someone's candidacy in our own town. And that, yeah, that's got to be a better and less expensive thing even than therapy. So there's that.
Therapy is also good. Therapy helps a lot. But I would say that, you know, having something somewhere to place your anger and place your rage, because it cannot fuel you forever. So being able to turn it into action, it's really cheesy. And the thing that when I say it out loud, I'm like, ugh, what a cliche. But it really does help. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
It really does. And one of the things that I've been noticing in the conversations that I've been having with different activists over the course of doing this podcast is how taking your anger about something that is an injustice or something that you see that isn't working as well as it should be working and shifting that into doing something out in the world really does matter. And I believe so strongly that each of us has a role to play in making this a better world and making our country specifically a better country. And whether it's running for office or, you know, running for missing and murdered Indigenous women or doing any kind of advocacy work for anything, just getting into that habit feels like something we've kind of gotten away from. We've gotten away, I think, from that sense of civic responsibility being on all of us rather than just on an elected few. And I think it's really important to not have that.
And it's not just about the impact of that work, although it certainly is. It's about the people you meet when you're doing it. You know, one of the reasons professional political operatives, you know, people like me have been working in campaigns and so for so long is because the community and the people that you work with are so great because they are people who share your values. They're people who give a shit enough to show up and take action on that. It's fun. It's really fun. And I think it is certainly about the doors that you knock and the votes that you get to show up, but it's also about the people you're knocking doors with. That community that you create when you're getting involved is life-giving. It creates joy.
It does. I mean, I've knocked a ton of doors in my day, and some days, as you said before, it's awful. I mean, I was door knocking in Savannah, Georgia. It was like 1,000 degrees. And, you know, you'd come up against people who were just not interested in talking to you and not nice about it. But I was with a friend, and so no matter what, it was kind of fun. And I met friends doing that. I met people I did not know. And because we were paired up doing our door knocking, we developed relationships that have sustained, even though I don't live in Savannah anymore. And it really does build community. And I think that that's also something that we're all really seeking in this time, because it's kind of a fractured point in our country. And having that community does make a huge difference.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to end the conversation by asking you what I've been asking my guests to do, which is give listeners three simple actions they can take. You've told us a whole bunch of things in this conversation, but if you could give us three things to take us out that we can move on that are just simple, doable things that we can say, oh yeah, I can do at least one of those things. That would be wonderful.
Well, first thing you should do, and it's not simple, it's not easy, but everyone who listens to this should consider it, is run for office. If you go to runforwhat.net, it's our online tool. You can enter your address and see all the local offices at your location. In about 2/3 of the country, it's still not too late to get on the ballot for 2020, but there will be elections and hopefully 2021, 22, and beyond. So start thinking about it. And I promise if you decide to run, we will be there with you every step of the way. Second thing you should do is volunteer with Run for Something or with a local campaign. If you decide to volunteer with us, you go to our website, sign up, we'll plug you in, help you screen candidates, connect to campaigns. If you'd rather work directly with a race in your area, we have a whole bunch of endorsed candidates on our website. We can plug you in directly. But I highly encourage you, even and especially if you live in a quote-unquote battleground state, or you live somewhere where maybe there will be no presidential engagement at all, knocking doors and making calls for a local election or cleaning bathrooms for a local candidate will go a long way towards helping our values win at the ballot. The third thing you can do is, if you are inspired or excited by the work that Run for Something is doing, a $5 donation, or even better, a $5 monthly donation, will go such a long way towards our efforts. And I cannot say enough how grateful I am to the tens of thousands of people who contributed over the last 3 years. It's really hard to do this work, but we're able to keep it up because people care and are inspired and are willing to put their money where their mouth is. So thank you in advance if that's what you decide to do this week.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for those suggestions. Those are wonderful. And I'm going to put them in the episode notes as well so that people can just go back and look at them and see them right there. So that's just perfect. I'm so glad that I got to talk with you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Thank you so much for supporting young progressive candidates all around the country.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And to everyone out there listening, remember, each of us has a role to play in addressing the challenges of our world. So be sure to follow the link in the episode notes to my website, where you can find suggestions and guidance on creating your own everyday activist plan. Thank you for joining me for this episode, and I will be back with another episode very soon.